Hi, this is Soren Ondahl, CIO of Blue Orca Capital. I'm sitting in as a guest host today for the Chopping Block, and we're welcoming Dan David from Wolfpack Research.
Hey, Soren, how are you?
Dan, tell us what you got.
What do we got? We're short B. Riley today. B. Riley is a second-tier investment bank that dove headfirst into the speculative mania of 2020 and 2021, which worked during the mania period. But it didn't work so well in 2022 when they got smashed in the face. And it's not going to work well in 2023, in our opinion, as we see from our research. Just talking about their loan book and their portfolio book, which is really their business, our research indicates that Riley's cash and net investments fell $950 million in 2022. Took them from a $600 million surplus to a $350 million deficit. We estimate that their NAV has fallen to $400 million in 2022 and will go negative as we estimate another $400 to $700 million will get wiped out this year.
So interesting stuff. Do you want to start taking us through examples in the loan portfolio, some of the situations you've identified, which you think are the sort of indicative of, I guess, the quality of the loan practices or most likely to be in a situation where they're either troubled or potentially distressed?
Well, I mean, look, I guess, as we talk about their NAV and our estimate on their NAV, we do have to say that, you know, Riley has a $1.1 billion minimum NAV requirement in their credit agreement. Now, Riley makes a private subsidiary the prime guarantor in this credit agreement. No one could see how close they are to violating that covenant because of that. So as their NAV goes lower and lower, and we're estimating it's $400 million at the end of 2022, and you know we think it's going to go negative this year, we're just going to have to take B. Riley's word for it that they've got us covered in this black box of a private subsidiary that's guaranteeing the loan book.
You say it's a black box in terms of the intercompany relationships. What is the, maybe at a high level, walk us through exactly how it's supposed to work or how shareholders understand it to work between the listed investment bank and the other private subs?
Yeah, look, I mean, if you have private subsidiaries that are doing certain things that, immaterial to the business, then the see-through isn't that important. But right now we're looking at their NAV falling to $400 million, as I said, could go negative from what we can see. And now they've got this private subsidiary that guarantees their credit agreement and their covenants, but they're not giving us any see-through on it. Now, I think that's where it gets shady. That's one of the shady things that they do, that you're just going to have to take their word for it. So no, I don't know what's in that private subsidiary. You don't know what's in there. Nobody else does except for Nomura and B. Riley. And that's really not how you treat the investing public, right? So, I guess we find out that they breach covenant when Nomura tests it every quarter and it becomes a problem.
I mean, Nomura is a top tier investment bank.
They are. They're not going to put up with any shit. I mean, like if this thing truly, starts dropping again, another $400 to $700 million, and they don't have, $1.5 to $2 billion in that private subsidiary, they're in big trouble.
Interesting stuff, Dan. So why don't we get into the nitty gritty here? Take us through the first example.
Yeah, look, their loan book is particularly bad. Not that, believe me, once we get to their equity portfolio, not that that's any better. But, we see like $300 million in corporate loans to companies that are in default or at high risk of default. And as these negative catalysts we're going to discuss hit Riley wave after wave this year, we think Riley will end up cutting its dividend or even collapse under the strain. I guess the first thing we should have to talk about is what's most recently in the news, Coors Scientific, which, Coors since inception or since becoming public has been anything but scientific. And Riley, invested $42 million in Coors in a loan. And prior to Coors filing for bankruptcy, Riley offered him another $72 million in loans. I don't know anybody else that would have done that, but Riley did. Coors turned it down, knowing they were going to go into bankruptcy anyway. and file for bankruptcy, Chapter 11. This hit Riley's stock. I mean, just this $42 million loan hit Riley's stock. Riley came back out, reassured investors that its exposure to crypto was just 2%. Stock went up a little bit, but it didn't, you know, wholly recover. So, you know, right after this, Riley reverses course, you know, injects into the bankruptcy proceedings and provides a dip loan of $70 million to Coors. Now, with the $70 million is nowhere near going to get it done. When you look at the budget for the $70 million dip loan, it's ridiculous. With the $70 million, I'll say that's a lot more secured than the $42 million, but it's completely unreasonable to look at what Coors would have to achieve in the next 6 months not to completely run out of money again.
How does that impact the rest of Riley's business? Or would you consider Core Financial to be almost a canary in the coal mine?
Yeah, well, that and Gree, which we'll discuss next, are kind of canaries in the coal mine of what Riley's willing to do. I mean, you take this dip loan of $70 million and it's risking, you know, good money after bad. They're not going to get the $42 million back, in our opinion. I mean, the $70 million in dip loan is a lot more secure than the $42 million. But if you look at the details, which a lot of people don't, they just look at the headline that, you know, Coors was given a bit of a lifeline here. The dip budget is totally unreasonable. It assumes a sevenfold increase in hosting revenues over 6 months. Like, they're supposed to go from, you know, what they did, a little over north of $1 million a month in hosting revenues to $7 million a month in March. Why? How? And it doesn't even account for increased power costs or CapEx or OpEx. The budget assumes revenues from mining will stay flat despite losing market share, since they can't buy additional miners. So they're not going to keep their same hash rate.
So why do B. Riley investors care about this? Because they're gonna have to take a write down on Coors in the coming quarters.
Yeah, I mean, they're kicking the can down the road. That's going to be one more write down. As I was saying, I think, you know, $300 million of their loan book is in jeopardy. I mean, these are companies that are either in default or at high risk of in default, and this is one of them. And you know, to look at the financials and the situation that Coors is in, and to see, you know, a banking institution come in and say, okay, well, you know, look, they only have $900 million in debt in their capital structure, and $273 million of that debt is financing to Bitmain, which is really the only place you can get miners. So they're not gonna get additional miners to get themselves out of this. I mean, if we're generous and we assume they have a 20% increase in hosting revenue, it'll still run out by June. So they're gonna need more money. And again, I've got, you know, other companies that are indicative of this, that roll up into that $300 million number.
Why don't you take us through another example of potentially impaired or either default or on the verge of default that you think B. Riley investors or shareholders?
Yeah, there are two or three examples in there that I think are particularly egregious. Like, you know, one of the biggest dumpster fires is a small loan, $11 million loan to Greenridge Generations Holdings, another bit mining company. Rather than seeing this as a sunk cost of $11 million, because, you know, Gree missed 2 months' payments, is in fire sale mode and had already sold most of its miners to another creditor, needs to sell land to pay off some of the Riley debt. Riley, again, decides to lean in and agreed to purchase 1 million shares of stock in an offering underwritten by, you know, of course, B. Riley at 75 cents. Now, B. Riley gets 15% of the proceeds, but they're screwed if the shares go back to where they were a month ago at 30 cents. I see no reason why they won't. If you get into some of the bigger loans, Accela Technologies owes $75 million. It trades at 6 cents. You know, it failed to make a payment to a creditor in January, and it has until February 19th to make up for that, to pay. And its trailing 12-month losses are $125 million. How are these guys coming through? And then you get into Riley SPAC. We expect B. Riley SPAC, BPM 250, to get liquidated in May, wiping out $175 million off their balance sheet.
Why do you guys think that? Is it because they're going to be unable to close on a deal, or is there, you know, take us through that logic?
Well, I don't think they're going to be able to close on the deal for a couple of reasons. One, in the general macro environment, SPACs are out, right? The activity is down in general. But even if that wasn't the case, if you look at B. Riley's last SPAC, you know, BRPM, you know, 125, it was horrendous disaster. FaZe Holdings. B. Riley had a disastrous history in that SPAC. Just getting it to market was something to read if you want to do that. But what happened afterwards, it issued a going concern in its first quarter after going public. It trades at sub $1 after executive lockups expired. Riley lost over $100 million on shares it owned in fourth quarter. And Riley was a SPAC sponsor, investment bank, bridge financer, and pipe financer. 92% of the investors redeemed their shares. So I don't think investors are looking forward to the next SPAC from B. Riley, but you know, I'm excited about it. And I think the shorts are excited about their next SPAC.
Have they impaired the FaZe investment already, or is that in process?
Yeah, I mean, like the $100 million in fourth quarter, and you know, you could transparently see all of that. We'll see how that shakes out in this next quarter, but you know, FaZe is not coming back. That's sunk cost. That's gone.
All right, Dan. Well, you've talked about Coors, you've talked about Zella, you've talked about Gree, and you've actually just talked to us through it right now about their Riley SPAC, FaZe, and the trouble there. You know, what other sort of examples of related parties or potentially impaired loans or companies that might be distressed that you want to discuss?
Look, I know this is number intensive, Soren, but it's all about the numbers with Riley, whether they want to make it, you know, a colorful story or not. And you're right. You know, I could go on and on about some of their bad loans. I mean, a couple more to talk about. They do have a related party in Babcock and Wilcox, which they guarantee $110 million for some reason. And I say for some reason because, you know, I'm not doing a whole ton of research on a company when you're seeing that the cash ratio is 0.15, the quick ratio is 0.61, the debt is $334 million, right? The equity is negative cash flow, and they cut their EBITDA estimates by last year. An even bigger issue, since you're asking, if we take a look at Arena Holdings, it owes $98 million due by the end of the year. Now, it's had $21 million in operational losses over the last 12 months and $13 million in cash on hand at the end of Q3. So really a lot of this is just once you're able to get into the loan book, which is not that easy to find, by the way, because, you know, Riley doesn't disclose much of their loan book. You've got to go into Edgar, do a lot of searching for it, and then go into these companies and see what they disclose about the loans. And that's where we're able to find this information that we don't think the market, there's no way they've fully digested it, because I've just gone through, what, $300 million that looks very, very shaky at best.
Interesting stuff. I mean, you've talked about the loan portfolio. What about the equity portfolio?
Yeah, it's just as bad. It's not saving them, really. I mean, B. Riley lost $400 million in its equity portfolios last year in 2022, and it added $500 million in debt. Some of the highlights, you know, going through those, B. Riley's largest equity portfolio, B. Riley Financial Inc., you know, as disclosed in its 13F, you get a little more see-through with the equity portfolio. Its largest portfolio had a negative 45% returns. 30 out of 31 operating companies had a negative return in 2022. 20 out of 31 operating companies recorded free cash flow losses through Q3 of 2022. 12 out of 31 of those companies, 40%, discussed going concerns within the last year. And we see six more headed in the same direction. So, you know, what's going to save them in their equity portfolio? This leaves their dial-up business as their backstop. Have we talked about their dial-up business?
No, tell us about the dial-up business.
Yeah. Well, look, these are fantastic businesses in the 90s. you know, you look at Riley, they bought Magic Jack and Net Zero, Juno, which is, you know, rolled up in United Online 5 years ago. They paid $143 million for Magic Jack, and the entire purchase was allocated to intangibles because the tangible assets had a negative value. Actually, 110% of the value was in intangibles. They also paid $169 million for United Online, which is Juno and Net Zero. $50 million of it went to allocated to intangibles. So that's $200 million in goodwill and intangibles when, you know, when purchased, and it's not really made any major impairments to dial-up internet businesses. But it has disclosed that these businesses, it's disclosed over and over again that these businesses are declining. So it doesn't seem like that's going to be any help to them at all. And really, we should be looking at an impairment.
All right. Well, you know, you've talked about the equity portfolio. You've talked about the loan portfolio. How does B. Riley trade compared to other financial institutions? Like, is this an expensive stock versus its peer group?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you would think that, you know, most of retail and the investing community would look at B. Riley as the second tier investment bank they are and look at these risky loans and this poor portfolio performance. And they should not be trading at a premium to peers, but not only are they trading at a premium to peers, they're trading double what their peers are trading in some cases, or the average of 2.9 price to book versus an average of 1.38 price to book. It's trading three times price to book. Cowen is what Cowen is trading, 20% higher than Piper Sandler. Those are near peers that I don't see are near the jeopardy that they're in. And then you put in Jefferies, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley. I understand they're, you know, much bigger banks, but these things are also trading at like sometimes three times less than Riley. It makes no sense other than Riley offers a dividend that, you know, I don't know that they're going to be able to keep up with. And, you know, if that NAV that we're looking at $400 million at the end of this year, you know, starts to continue to go negative this year and lose even more, and we have to count on some private subsidiary to bail us out that we have no see-through on, I can't see why they trade at a premium.
Sometimes when you look at companies that trade at a premium, it's because of they trade at a growth premium. Do you think that their growth trajectory is going to continue vis-a-vis, I guess, some of the more established peers? Or do you think a lot of their earnings have been in the really punchy or frothy part of the market that they're going to have trouble replicating going forward?
Oh, I definitely think they're going to have trouble replicating it going forward. I mean, look, if Riley looked at last year and basically said, okay, fine, we're going to really have to tighten our belt. We're going to have to cut the div. We're going to have to get rid of some of this bad debt. And, you know, we're going to start growing at a moderate rate again. I could maybe see that, but they're really leaning into it. I think their hope this year is that 2023 is going to be 2021 all over again, or 2020 all over again. And it's just not. I mean, interest rates are continuing to rise, especially with that last jobs number. That's not going to help out B. Riley. You know, these bad investments are not going to get better in this environment. So as they continue to make these loans and their NAV goes lower and lower, there's going to be more questions about their ability to be a going concern, certainly about their ability to pay a dividend. I guess they're going to pay, you know, they're projected to pay $120 million in dividends this year. I don't think that's going to happen.
So when you talk about the, I guess, what you would say medium to near-term catalyst, you know, do you think that, you know, let's say they have additional impairments, is this something where you think there's going to be a dividend cut? Is there going to be an equity issuance? Are they going to raise capital? Does their balance sheet have the breathing room in order to take on more debt?
Look, I think for the time being, they might be able to do that. I certainly don't think their current creditor is going to want to give them more, given what they did last year, given where they are right now. You know, the current catalysts are, you know, what's happening soon. Obviously, Coors is a terrible investment by any stretch. I think the $42 million that they originally invested is sunk cost. The $70 million they may get back. And, you know, their hope that Bitcoin's going to go back to $60,000 a coin is, you know, I think just kind of playing Russian roulette. You know, GRI, another dumpster fire. And then some of these other investments that, look, I mean, when you're losing hundreds of millions of dollars or, you know, tens of millions, you're not going to turn that around over, you know, a year's period and pay a $98 million loan off at the end of the year. And the SPAC, I just don't see the SPAC happening at all. I don't see anybody after what happened with FaZe, you know, putting that kind of money into their next SPAC, which, you know, if it doesn't happen by May, that's, you know, like I said, $175 million off the balance sheet. So these are the near-term catalysts that I think are going to cause them big problems.
Is there anything unusual about some of their offerings, about any of the debt in their structure?
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that, you know, under the heading of everything we just talked about is I think really, really concerning in the near term and throughout this year. You know, we also have to talk about the baby bonds that they've issued, $1.2 billion in baby bonds. And they definitely don't have as much protection as regular bonds, as you know, Soren. They're unsecured. These particularly are Covlite. They essentially sit right on top of the equity and capital structure. The coupon rate is between 5 and 7%, which, you know, in my view, is completely mispriced for the risk. 25% of the holders are institutional, which means 75% of the holders are retail investors. And it just makes me think for a second. I wonder how many of those retail holders were encouraged to buy these baby bonds by B. Riley's Wealth Management and Advisory Services.
I mean, really interesting stuff. If you want to just summarize the, you know, elevator pitch on the short thesis, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, look, summing up my short thesis or taking an elevator pitch approach to it, you know, when you look at Riley holistically, from their loan portfolio to their equity portfolio to their offerings in wealth management services to, you know, even their premium to their competitors, you know, trading at double price to book of these other banks, it doesn't add up at all. More losses coming. I think this would be a much different story if you believed that these companies that I've talked about and others are going to turn it around. I don't really believe that any of these companies that I've talked about are going to turn it around. Not one. Maybe one will. Who knows? But I don't believe they will. I don't, you know, Coors has been, in my opinion, an awful company since inception. I mean, Bitmining companies, you know, range from bad to the worst. And I think Coors and Green Ridge Holdings are among the worst. And then you've got all these other distressed debt issues that are going to come to roost this year, both in their loan book and their portfolio. And I think that's our real investment thesis.
Great. Interesting stuff, Dan. Thanks for joining us here today.